joining us is our good friend Senator Blumenthal, who hasn't been on in quite a while. Senator Blumenthal, first of all, it's been a while. I want to congratulate you on your own reelection, which seems ages ago, but really isn't. You're welcome. Congratulations to you. So,
thank you, and to you, too.
Thank you. I'm getting sworn in tonight. You know, I completely forgot about it.
That is wonderful.
I forgot about it.
Oh, you better show up.
I not only show up, I had to organize it. If you're not sworn in by January 4th, I don't know what happens to you, but I'm leaving on Wednesday to Florida, and I'm not back until the 3rd anyway. So, yes, I'm doing it fast, fast, fast. Anyway, so, Senator Blumenthal, you're in the news. You're actually on the front page of The Hour today talking about the scourge of domestic violence. We're in the middle of holiday season. What would you like to talk about? Let me give the floor to you. What's on your mind?
Well, let's talk about domestic violence a bit because, you know, the tragic killing of Julie Minogue, a mother of three, by her intimate partner, boyfriend.
Yeah, so terrible.
Was needless, senseless, absolutely outrageous. And rather than focus on a single police officer, we need to look at the entire system, which all too often allows victims and survivors like Julie Minogue to be vulnerable. And protective orders to be unenforced and guns to remain in the household. This death was not by a gun, but they are a very common form of killers in domestic violence. Women who are victims of domestic violence are 5 times more likely to be killed if there's a gun in the home, and protective orders need to be enforced more aggressively and consistently. There is a combination of factors that can lead to fatality or just to the continuance of brutality and physical violence abuse in homes. And domestic violence is a scourge that we need to combat. It's a cycle. And that's why I formed Men Make a Difference, Men Against Domestic Violence, an organization in Hartford, only men, to spread the word that men have a responsibility here. It's on us. Because obviously men are the ones who most frequently, 90%+ of the time, they're responsible for domestic violence. And they see it in their own homes growing up, and they perpetuate the cycle of domestic violence. So we need to break that cycle.
You know, we definitely do. It's complex. I will say, we're chatting with Senator Blumenthal, I will say that We end up having to, and we should, spend a lot of time about with the legal system and the people we know that are already the aggressors. And we have to focus on that because clearly it's failing us. But I also think that we ought to be, and I think we ought to be insisting that part of graduating from 12th grade is included in our curriculum, healthy relationship learning. And boundaries, so that kids, as they're starting out their first loves at 15, 16, 17 years old, they right away know and they right away learn, oh, this is the sign of a partner who's being too controlling, or, oh, I am being too controlling. Why do I want to control my partner so much? Why do I want to isolate my partner so much? What's going on with me that I'm so insecure that I have to have her on a leash? So I just think that we have to get to it. And the root cause is there's some sickness in our culture. There's a pervasive sickness in our homes, as you said, that leads to generation after generation of this. And I think we have to get to it in a neutral setting in a classroom.
You're absolutely right, Lisa. It has to happen in the classroom. It has to begin earlier than the 12th grade.
Yeah.
It has to begin.
Yeah, like sixth and seventh.
In elementary school.
Yeah, that's right. That's true.
Where kids are taught, you know, if you have a disagreement with someone, you don't need to use your fists. You can talk about it and work it out. And you don't need to fight physically over it. And that kind of social and emotional learning, let's put a name to it, can be funded by the federal government. I've worked very, very hard for more funding, inspired in part by Scarlett Lewis, whose son was killed at Sandy Hook. Mm-hmm. She has the Jesse Lewis Choose Love movement, but there are lots of other organizations that are working for social emotional learning. But also role models are important, and that's the reason why I started this organization called Men Make a Difference, Men Against Domestic Violence, consisting of broadcasters, sports, well-known sports personalities, police officers, public officials, educators, who can be role models. And they go into classrooms, they go into schools, talk to kids, show that domestic violence isn't cool, it isn't something to be emulated, and those kinds of role models are important. And then to the Violence Against Women Act, VAWA, which I've championed, has to provide more money for the hotlines and the shelters and really the means for women to exit those relationships that are abusive. You know, it takes a lot of courage and strength to break an abusive relationship. People often assume, oh, well, you know, she's being beaten, so of course she's going to leave. But it takes real guts and grit to break off a relationship, even when it's abusive, or maybe especially when it's abusive. And I've seen women with their children, all of their belongings in plastic bags, going to a shelter, leaving and breaking with an abusive relationship. It takes real courage for a woman to do that, and we need to support that kind of courage in any way that we can.
So, well, and I know, and
financially as well as emotionally, it's important.
Yeah, and I had a woman on last week from Connecticut Protective Moms, and that's been a very effective local grassroots organization too. And she said that, and I've heard this before, Senator Blumenthal, that the most dangerous time for women in terms of their own physical safety is when they actually make that move to leave. Like, that is really, it's not made up that it's dangerous. It really is dangerous for them. So they stay very often because there's an awareness that if they stay, and they're usually mothers, at least they're alive for their children. And when they leave, they know they may not be.
That's exactly right. And that's why the protective orders that separate people from guns or weapons are very important at that point. And there's a gap in many of the state laws that says in the first 10, 12 days or 2 weeks or 3 weeks that the protective order removing or separating people from guns doesn't apply. That's the time when it's most necessary. And so that's the kind of smart approach the red flag laws that I have worked to implement in the Safer Communities Act passed by Congress in August is very, very important because it separates people from guns at that moment when they are most vulnerable, when the rage is at its highest, and we need to make the protection highest as well.
We're chatting with Senator Richard Blumenthal, 203-333-9422. I think we have a couple of people who'd like to say hi. Senator Blumenthal, are you? What are you doing for the holidays? What do you do around this time of year? Do you get away from Connecticut? Do you sort of recharge your own batteries with your family? What do you do?
Well, we lit the menorah lights last night, the first night of Hanukkah, and I enjoyed your description of the Jewish connection to the Christmas holiday. You know, there's also another lesson in Hanukkah, and I've been just kind of mulling it over in my mind. You know, Judah Maccabee fought to literally win against Antiochus and rededicate the Second Temple. He was vastly outnumbered. He was outarmed. He was a small band, the Maccabees, triumphed over Antiochus and his massive army. And there's a lesson for us today in that triumph, not only in lighting the candles, you know, the miracle that the oil lasted for 8 days when it was only supposed to be enough for one, but the triumph of that good over evil is a lesson for Ukraine, just to give one example, where the Ukrainians are vastly outnumbered. They're fighting for their freedom and independence. They are literally resisting against a war criminal Vladimir Putin, who has committed genocide through his troops. And I've been to the mass graves in Bucha outside of Kyiv, visited there myself, talked to townspeople who observe what happened. So it reminds me of the continuing struggle that we see repeated. Obviously, it's not a religious struggle necessarily, but in some ways it is, because the Ukrainian Orthodox Church has been the target of subjugation by the Russians over literally centuries. And so the striving for religious tolerance and freedom is very much with us today. So to answer your question very directly, I'm going to try to be with my family over this period. We have four children. Two of them are married. Two others have very, let me say, significant others. And my two sons, my three sons and daughter, hopefully will be with us for a good part of the holiday. But obviously they have their own lives, and they're going to try to be with us for as much of it as they can.
Are you a grandfather yet?
I am not yet.
Me neither.
We're very much hoping.
I know, hoping. Let's say it together. I know what you mean.
There's only so much, you know, we
right.
can do
totally.
In that department.
Totally. Can't rush it. I mean, it is what it is. It's so wonderful to chat with you. And I'm thinking maybe Victor Zelensky is today's Judah Maccabee, right? You know, a scruffy little Jewish guy who's like a hammer. You know, Representative Jim Himes was one of the first guests I had on after Ukraine was attacked. And he came on the show and he was so dejected. I remind him of this a lot because what was it, last February already? And I said to him, you know, let's talk about this. And he's like, oh, it's going to be over by the end of the weekend. Forget it. The Ukrainians can't win. And this is what I said. And I can play it back. I said, are you really sure? Because I don't want to give up yet. Right. It's my fighting spirit. I'm like, you know, are you sure they're going to have to lose? I mean, who knows? And he's like, no, they're going to be overwhelmed. It's going to be over within the week. And a lot of times since then, I've said to Congressman Himes, I said, you see, you lost faith too soon. Right. I mean, I think they're going to win. I think they're going to win.
I came back from my first visit to Ukraine this year. It was in January, shortly before the invasion. And everybody was talking, just like you've recounted now, about how quickly Russia was going to conquer Ukraine. And I visited with Volodymyr Zelensky in his office, literally spoke with him in a bipartisan group of senators for about an hour. And I came away thinking, you know, our United States military, our United States State Department, even our president has underestimated Zelensky and the people of Ukraine, because he is what he is because of the people
totally.
Of Ukraine and, totally. And their fierce resistance. He may be a Judah Maccabee, but they are literally the people, the heroes who are going to triumph
they
over
are.
The evil here. And I said to President Biden personally, I said to him, you know, Ukraine can win this thing if we give them the support they need. And fortunately, the United States has come through. We're providing ever-increasing support. I hope this week we'll do another supplemental of nearly $30 billion with more military and humanitarian aid. And I'm literally on my way to Washington today, hopefully to achieve that aid, because the United States is critical, so is NATO. And I believe, as you do, that Ukraine can triumph here.
Well, there are people now second guessing. I'm getting a lot of emails that we shouldn't be fighting a proxy war with Russia over the future of Ukraine, and that we've gotten in too deep and too wide with more and more asks of America. So am I hearing from you, Senator Blumenthal, that you still firmly believe that we should continue to support this Ukrainian government and resistance? Is that what I'm hearing?
We absolutely should do it, not just for the moral imperative. And there is a moral imperative to conquering genocide and war crime. But also, it's in the interest of our national security. You know, when you think about, let's say, $30 billion, sounds like a lot of money. It is a lot of money. Our defense budget is in excess of $800 billion. $800 billion. We spend $2 billion on every submarine, and that's a bargain, let me tell you, for national security. We produce them here in Connecticut. I'm very proud that Connecticut is the submarine capital of the world. But keep in mind that what we're fighting in Ukraine is aggression against not only Ukraine, but against NATO, against Finland, against Sweden, against NATO allies, Poland, and others who are at risk. And if you don't believe me, just listen to their leaders. NATO is at risk, and so is our national security, because if NATO is attacked, we have to go all in. So if we can win against Putin in Ukraine, we will stop a much more costly and painful kind of battle that we'll need to fight. And Putin must be stopped. He must be deterred. And that's why our national security is at stake. So even if you don't care about the humanitarian interest, even if you just don't care about the moral imperative, keep in mind our national security and defense is at stake.
Senator Blumenthal, happy Hanukkah to you and your family. Thank you so much for coming on our show. A happy and a healthy new year to you. And we'll chat with you after the first of the year. My best to your wife and your kids.
I look forward to it. Happy holidays to all of your listeners. And to you, have a good time in Florida.
Absolutely.
Safe travel.
That's where I go.
Take care.
Senator Blumenthal. Joining us right now is Molly King from Greenwich Academy. And the reason I've asked Molly on the show, this is the second leader of Greenwich Academy who's been with us, is because I've been so impressed with the effort that they're making to talk to our community about raising young people of good character and what the priorities in an education ought to be. Molly, welcome to the Lisa Wexler Show. Hello.
Hello. How are you, Lisa? It's nice to speak with you today.
It's very nice to speak with you. So I'm looking at your bio. I know that you have been all about STEM, which is, you know, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. You've been on the numerous boards of many different kinds of related efforts. And clearly, your passion for your entire career has been molding the education and character of young people. Why is that, Molly? Where did that come from?
You know, it really is a vocation, Lisa, and I remember flirting briefly with going into business, and I was at a banking interview, and the interviewer said to me, "You're no banker." it was a really good wake-up call to what I knew was true. I had the good fortune to have amazing role models in my parents, and while they weren't educators per se, they were extraordinary people. And that idea of giving back in the way that we're best suited to do so was ingrained in me from a young age. And the natural venue just seemed to be connecting with young people, working at summer camps, coaching, being a student teacher. It just all seemed to lead to the same path, and that was being in a school.
And where did you grow up, Molly?
I grew up in Dover, Massachusetts, a small town. I had the good fortune of going kindergarten through grade 12 in a wonderful public school system and just had a tremendous experience there and was led to the independent school network because as I graduated from college, liberal arts college, Bowdoin, and didn't have teaching certification, independent schools don't require that. And so I went right into working in schools in Connecticut, actually. I was working at a boarding school at Taft, and it was a great way to start out my career. And, of course, my room and board were covered, which was enormously appealing as a young person starting out.
You know, Molly, I don't know if you know this, we're chatting with Molly King, but our producer, Melissa Chessman, is a graduate of Taft.
Oh, my gosh, that's fantastic.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
Good for her. And yeah. I have to say, listening to your last segment to the esteemed Senator Blumenthal, I had the good fortune. His daughter is a graduate of Greenwich Academy. So I've been inspired by him, by his wife, the entire family, very notably his wonderful daughter for many, many years.
Well, that's wonderful. We're chatting with Molly King. So, Molly, I'm interested in knowing, because the independent route isn't available for most families.
For sure.
It isn't available financially. It isn't feasible. Transportation. There's a million reasons why, including the fact that a lot of parents like myself chose public school because we wanted our kids to fall out of the bus every day and theoretically play on the street with other kids on the street. And that was really important to me. Of course, we live in a time now where parents are afraid to let their kids play out on the street, but that's their problem. It wasn't mine. Anyway, I don't know how to change that again. I don't know how to bring back some elemental things about creating a feeling of spirit of freedom. And of individual agency anymore. We're living in a time, and this is me editorializing, Molly, so I want to hear from you. But it seems to me more and more, and I have dear friends, mothers in their 40s, who and dear friends of mine who are raising kids in every age, because depending upon when they started, right, every age. But it seems to me they're so much more intrusive, and they're so much more fearful. And they use the fear, the excuse of the fear, as an excuse to intrude. And I just want to hear about that from your point of view, because I don't think that that's raising particularly healthy children.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. And honestly, you know, whether one is in public schools or independent schools, and I would just say on the latter that most independent schools, certainly ours, have robust need-based financial aid programs and meet the demonstrated need of all of their families in a way that most colleges don't, and that is free of loans. So I would want to just have that out there. But really importantly, you know, whether we're raising our children in public schools or independent schools, the goals are the same. And I love the language that you used around freedom and agency, because those characteristics are just so central both to education in its purest form and the raising of children. And when you talk about fear, you're absolutely right that the baseline of fear and anxiety, which has already been on the rise in the certainly in the nearly two decades that I've been head of Greenwich Academy, but really spiked during the pandemic. And we simply haven't seen that reset as quickly as we would like. And so I try, when I'm working with parents, I try very hard, and I have two grown children who are steeped in raising their own children. I try to lead with empathy and without judgment, because it is anxiety provoking to raise children right now when you're thinking about the very thing that you cite, you know, that not all parents can feel free to let their children play out in the street with kids in the neighborhood. So, you know, these are not small things, but you're absolutely right that fear and anxiety can interfere with the freedom and agency that we want to see in our children. And so what's a school administrator's job? It is to manage that, and it is to ensure that you're instilling trust, certainly, in your parent body so that they know how deeply committed you are to raising children of great character who have that sense of agency you referenced. And if that tendency, that fear-based tendency to overly manage, to curate children like they are a walking resume, if that begins to interfere, to really step up and to protect the educational process, to protect the teachers who are on the front lines of it, and to ensure that parents understand that what we are doing is in the best interest of their child and therefore in direct partnership with them as parents.
We're chatting with Molly King. Molly, what is, you're the head of school at Greenwich Academy. I see that, the head of school, 203-333-9422. I know so many teachers and so many administrators who are burnt out, and they don't say that they're burnt out because of the kids. They say they're burnt out because of the parents.
Right, right. It's true. I mean, and if you think it's a double whammy, really, because these teachers in public and independent schools have truly been frontline heroes during the pandemic. They were just as afraid as the rest of us as getting COVID, and I'm speaking very much of the pre-vaccine environment, and yet what did they do? First and foremost, they had to turn on their head an enterprise which is deeply personal and intimate in its scale, and that is the process of teaching, and they had to go remote to a process that was virtual, disconnected from those face-to-face interactions. And that is an incredibly difficult thing to do. Think of the expertise any of us have, and that over a space of a couple of weeks, being asked to turn that on its head and do something completely different. And then as they were managing that higher fear and anxiety, it often manifested itself in criticism. And so to have done the heroic thing on the front lines, being so dedicated to children, doing one's very best, whether one's school was in person or whether it was virtual, and for all of us, it was virtual for a time, and then to be criticized for it, to be under another whole level of scrutiny because we're managing, you know, as I referenced, that ongoing fear and anxiety. It's been enormously difficult. So administrators, I think, are working doubly hard to maintain the morale. And I would say that there is a core group of parents in all of our schools that recognize the need to do this and have been great partners. It's a small but vociferous group of parents that can create challenges in any school.
We're chatting with Molly King, who is the head of School of Greenwich Academy. We're talking about approaches to education, difficulty with parents, pressures of fear, and a little bit of hovering going on. Molly King, one of the conversations that I've... Oh, Molly, your daughter Sally is on. That is cool. Hi, Sally. Welcome to the Lisa Wexler Show. Hello. Hi.
Hello. How are you?
I'm great. I'm so happy to have a now I get to eavesdrop on a conversation between you and your mother. This is good. I like this.
Lisa, thank you. Well, this is a work-related question, actually, for my mom. Almost 20 years at Greenwich Academy, you've seen a full generation of parenting occur. And I was curious if you could speak to, I'm a millennial parent, what could I learn from the Gen X?
Sally, you there?
Oop, it cut out for
but
a
I,
second.
I think we think I know what she was saying. Okay, yes. So she wants to know, what can they learn from Gen X? And I'll just say I'm on the young end of baby boomers. We're not all that different. So go ahead. Yep.
Yeah.
Right.
It's a great question because a lot has changed. I think that for the Gen Xers, that group, as opposed to the millennials, was frankly known for giving a little bit more space to their kids, what we were speaking of, not overly managing or being overly curatorial. But I guess what I would say when we get to the specifics of what has changed so radically that all parents are dealing with now is social media and the immediacy of communication. And so I would, it just wouldn't be a complete talk about parenting or education without recognizing just the profound impact that has had. And I would say the management by parents, because schools can only do so much, the language of any expert or educator is delay, delay, delay. Do not put an expensive piece of technology, which is largely beyond the control of parents, into a child's hands. A very unregulated world, and there are some wonderful parent controls and programs that we subscribe to, like Common Sense Media and others. But delay, delay, delay in terms of access to a largely unregulated world that can profoundly impact identity development in children, and that for parents can make them more anxious.
Sally, how old are your kids? Oops, Sally came and went. How old are your grandchildren? Molly.
Hers are 5 and 6.
I'm really curious to know if Sally seems to me in a bad area connection-wise. She keeps calling in. Sally, are you back? Because I'd like to know.
I'm back. Thank you so much.
So you have kids that are 5 and 6. Do they have a phone yet?
No, absolutely not. And I'd like to delay it as long as possible.
And are you already subject to feeling peer pressure that your kids don't have a screen, whereas some of their friends do?
Not so much the screen at this age, but certainly the over-curated program as pertains to afternoon activities, weekend activities, and all of that.
So how are you handling this as a mom? Are you letting your kids have some unstructured space? Do they always have to call for a play date, or is there anybody that they can just go over and hang with? I mean, I don't know. How does it work nowadays?
I'm trying to retain probably the best part of the pandemic, which was that they were forced to play together, and so they continue to do that. Mm. We didn't have the choice of outside activities, so to kind of retain that unstructured time and that home time, I think has been really important, and I've tried to carry that through.
Are you in our area? Are you raising your kids in the Connecticut suburban lifestyle? What lifestyle are you in?
I'm in New York City, which I think kind of presents its own challenges and benefits. We spend a lot of time out in Greenwich at my parents' house, but that's very much family time. It's less social.
It's interesting. I'm listening to you with great interest, Sally, because my daughter, Joanna, is living in Manhattan, and she bought a place with her husband. They got married 2 years ago, and she's thinking about starting a family in the next few years. And they want to stay in New York City, and they want us in Westport to be what your parents are for you in Greenwich. And they really want to make it work. And so, I mean, my son-in-law's already been reading Lenore Skenazy about free-range kids, and he's hoping, who I interviewed, by the way, when that book first came out 15 years ago. And he's hoping that, because he grew up in Israel in a very free, very different dynamic society, that and he grew up in nature, that he can let his kids have that freedom, that agency. I mean, 5 and 6 is young, but still, they can walk to the corner at some point, and they can do stuff, right?
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. This curated notion of parenting. Let's go back to Molly. We've just got about a minute, Molly.
Yeah.
So your best piece of advice for parents is keep them away from screens for as long as possible. But once the Pandora's box is out, then what? Then what do you say?
Then I think that consider that desire to curate and manage is fear-based, is anxiety-based. Am I going to somehow disadvantage my child if they don't opt in for that soccer team or that piano lesson or that chess tutor? In those moments where it feels overwhelming, enlist the school as a partner. Reach out to that teacher or that administrator and say, I'm struggling with this. What do you see? And ask for their view as that frontline advocate and witness, because the majority of those waking hours are at school. Enlist that expert that they are, and then listen and trust. I will often say to parents, I wish that you could trust that the day is so complete and so engaging for your children so that they could get in the car
and just decompress.
And just breathe and know that they have some downtime rather than eat really fast in the back seat and change their clothes so that they're all ready for the next activity.
We're going to get cut off. I agree with you. That's why I spent a lot of time watching Gilligan's Island.